And if despite all of that they ever manage to make money, the unions start asking for more wages so they don't make money then either.
That's a persuasive bullish argument. So why is United Airlines one of your largest long positions?
It is a controversial call, but that is how you make money when you are right. My view is that the lack of profitability in airlines has its origins back in the days when airlines were regulated. Regulation fostered the proliferation of airlines because prices were protected, and it also resulted in very high cost structures. When the airlines were deregulated, the legacy carriers, who had very high cost structures, had to compete with newcomers such as Southwest Airlines, who had a much lower cost structure because they had not been exposed to years and years of a pricing umbrella, which encouraged inefficiency. Two things happened that changed the investment outlook for airlines. First, with the exception of American Airlines, all the major carriers went through bankruptcy, which allowed them to restructure their costs. Second, the industry has been able to merge down to three major players, United, Delta, and American. Among the three, I think that United has the best route structure. United, along with its partners, controls approximately 50% of the flights from the U.S. to Asia and 40% of the flights to Europe. I believe that going forward, United can get their operating margin up to about 10%, which isn't that great, but it is fabulous for an airline. It would give United $6 per share earning power. At the current price of $20, earnings at that level would imply a P.E. ratio of only 3.3. I'm not willing to put out large multiple on United, but even a multiple of only 8 to 10 would imply that I have a chance of doubling to tripling my money back in the stock.
Can you give me another trade example that illustrates how you pick stocks?
One thing I try to do is find oil companies whose price reflects only current production without accounting for ongoing exploration programs that have the potential to significantly increase future production. It is a way of essentially getting free optionality. For example, we are long Petrominerales, a Colombian oil and gas company that currently produces about 40,000 barrels per day. The optionality in the trade is that Petrominerales has 600,000 acres, leased in the same region as their current producing wells, and they have a number of rigs drilling new wells there, but the market is not pricing in any of this potential additional production. The best time to enter this type of trade is after a disappointment. Petrominerales also has assets in Peru, and recently one of its competitors drilled a dry hole in Peru, which caused all the oil companies in the region to sell off sharply. We use this price break as an opportunity to buy the stock. Another good example of this trade concept is Canadian Natural Resources. We took a large position in this stock when they announced a new oil sands project, which had the potential to generate $1 billion a year in cash flow. Even then, it was obvious and clear that this production would be coming on stream. The market didn't assign any value to it. What tends to happen is that people who use fundamental screens, such as price to cash flow and other metrics, will not pick these stocks because the potential future revenue does not show up in the statistics.
Does the type of trade idea illustrated by this example apply only to oil producers, or does it have broader applicability?
The broader idea is getting optionality from a business opportunity that is not producing current revenues, but has the potential to produce future revenues, a concept that would apply to other industries as well. For example, in recent years, Apple was frequently priced at the value of their existing products without pricing in the potential for future revenues on new products, despite their consistent record of innovation. Sometimes the future opportunity may relate to asset values rather than increased cash flow. For example, one of our holdings is a company called Paramount Resources, which acquires land that has the potential for oil or gas exploration. They will identify interesting geological situations, lease the land, and just wait. They will sell the land once the area becomes discovered by oil companies, who start drilling exploratory wells in the vicinity. If you looked at Paramount's numbers, you would never buy the stock. It always looks expensive because they are capturing the resource, but are not developing it themselves. So its true value never shows up in the numbers. You have to be willing to look at their acreage and figure out what it's really worth from an asset basis rather than a cash flow basis.
Any other examples of companies with free optionality?
Celanese, which I mentioned before, is currently trading at only 10 or 11 times earnings, and they have a new process for making ethanol that could be a complete game changer for them. I don't think the market is attaching much, if any, value to this process because it hasn't gone into production. The first plant is scheduled to come on stream at the end of next year. I often find that the market won't pay anything for production potential that is more than a year away. As another example, we had a substantial long position in emerging market wireless during the past 5 years. Some developed countries have cell phone penetration rates greater than 100%. Some people have more than one cell phone. The simple idea that drove this investment was the expectation that the emerging market penetration rate, which at the time was about 60% for the sector, would approach closer to developed market rates because the utility of cell phones was so high. The general principle is that we look for future revenue generation that can be reasonably anticipated, but that is not reflected by the current market price. The idea is probably the single most important concept in our stock selection process. There is an important lesson provided by Claugus that is both specific to the stock market and also has general implications for all investors. Vary exposure based on opportunity. In terms of stock investing, Claugus will vary his net exposure between theoretical extremes at 70% net short and 110% net long, depending on the placement of current prices within the price band that contains 95% of all price observations. When stock prices are near the low end of the long-term price band, Claugus will hold a maximum long position. Conversely, when prices are near the upper end of the band, he will hold a maximum short position. Varying the net exposure based on the prevailing opportunity provides for substantial improvement over an investment approach that maintains net exposure within a narrow range. One of Claugus's major themes in selecting individual stocks is looking for companies that will benefit from a future development that is not being priced into the current market. The source of the improvement can take many forms, including anticipated new sources of production, new technology, an expected increase in asset values, and so on. Claugus says that if a revenue source is more than a year away, the market will often fail to assign any significant value to it. Claugus views these trades as providing free optionality. You pay a fair value for the stock based on the prevailing statistic only, but get the upside of the anticipated favorable development, e.g. new source of production, for free. Fundamental screens will fail to identify these stocks because the source of the bullish potential is not at all reflected in current statistics. A common error that traders make is to judge whether a trading decision was right or wrong based on the outcome. I offer you 2-to-1 odds on a fair coin toss, and you take the bet and lose. It may be a losing bet, but it is still a correct bet because, on balance, making the same decision repeatedly will be very profitable. Similarly, a losing trade can still reflect a correct trading decision. Claugus lost money in shorting what he terms Evel Knievel stocks in late 1999. But these trades were not mistakes because Claugus has found that shorting these companies is a winning strategy. There is no way of knowing a priori which individual trade is likely to be a winner. Traders need to accept that a certain percentage of good trades will lose money. As long as a profitable strategy is implemented according to plan, a trade loss does not imply a trading mistake. On the flip side, a winning trade can still be a poor trading decision. For example, if someone went long internet stocks at the beginning of January 2000 and liquidated at the end of February 2000, in terms of outcome, it would be a brilliant trade. But it would be a horrible trade in terms of making the same trading decision over and over again under similar circumstances. The market happened to top in early March, but it could just as easily have topped in early January. Even though the specific trade would have been profitable, if the same trading decision were made over and over again under similar circumstances, the net outcome would often be a large loss. Trading is a matter of probabilities. Any trading strategy, no matter how effective, will be wrong a certain percentage of the time. Traders often confuse the concepts of winning and losing traders with good and bad trades. A good trade can lose money, and a bad trade can make money. A good trade follows a process that will be profitable, at an acceptable risk, if repeated multiple times, although it can lose money on any individual trade. A bad trade follows a process that will lose money if repeated multiple times, but may make money on any individual trade. As an analogous example, a winning slot machine wager is still a bad bet because if repeated multiple times, it has a high probability of losing money. Chapter 12. Joe Vidich, Harvesting Losses.
Typically, the managers I select for interviews are managers that I either know or locate through networking. Joe Vidich is one of the exceptions. I found him by searching a hedge fund database, looking for funds with exceptionally high return/risk performance. The Manalapan Fund, which was launched in May 2001 and managed by Joe Vidich, stood out for its impressive performance statistics. I had never heard of either the fund or the manager. For the 10 years plus since the fund's inception, Vidich has averaged an annualized compounded net return of 18%, 24% gross return, with a maximum drawdown of only 8%. This modest maximum drawdown is exceptional for an equity hedge fund during 2001 to 2011, a time period that included two massive bear markets. Vidich has tremendously outperformed his sector. During the corresponding time period, the HFR Equity Hedge Index was up only 4% annualized with a maximum drawdown of nearly 29%. Less than one quarter of Manalapan's return with nearly four times the drawdown. And the index understates the average maximum drawdown because of the smoothing effect of diversification. Reflecting the combination of strong returns and moderate losses, the gain-to-pain ratio of the Manalapan is a very high 2.4. I originally met with Nick Davidge, the managing director who runs the business operations for Manalapan. At the time, I was living in Martha's Vineyard, and conveniently, Davidge was visiting Cape Cod. I took the ferry over and joined him for a waterside lunch on a pleasant summer day. Davidge explained how he became a principal of Manalapan. Davidge was the founder of a company that provided order routing software to market makers, and Joe Vidich was one of his clients. Davidge recalled, "What struck me about Joe when I first met him was that he was an intellectual who was also a trader." Through this association, Davidge became aware of Vidich's trading skills, particularly the effective way Vidich combined his longer-term investment themes with his reading of market sentiment and individual names. When Vidich launched his fund years later, Davidge was one of the first investors. After Davidge sold his company, he joined Vidich as a partner in Manalapan. Vidich combines longer-term investments with short-term trading that provides supplemental returns. For the investment portion of the portfolio, Vidich begins by formulating a big picture of the economy and the stock market. Next, Vidich looks for themes that drive him to sectors and subsectors. As a final step, Vidich does fundamental analysis and observes trading activity to select the best individual stocks within the targeted sectors. Vidich's timing in entering and exiting these positions is heavily influenced by what he calls his assessment of sentiment, price action relative to events. Vidich or his analysts listen to about 300 conference calls every quarter. The market action following these conference calls can provide Vidich with important clues. For example, if a company reports generally bullish news in its conference call, and the next day the market is up, but the stock is down, Vidich would view this price action as a bearish indicator. Before starting his fund, Vidich spent a dozen years as a market maker and proprietary trader for various small brokerage firms. Vidich explains that since the order flow from retail investors is heavily long-biased, the market maker is by definition a short trader. For every buy order a market maker fills, he has to trade out of the resulting short position. Vidich feels that because of his many years of experience as a market maker, his trading skills are most finely developed on the short side. Even though long-term investment themes and position trades are core to Vidich's investment approach, he is an extremely active trader. The turnover for the fund is approximately 20x, of which about 15x is on the short side. Vidich's net exposure varies widely and has ranged between 80% net long to 37% net short. Vidich's firm, Manalapan Oracle Capital Management, is located in a small town in central New Jersey. Vidich is an amateur artist, and Manalapan's offices can double as an art gallery, as his paintings adorn every wall. His style ranges between post-impressionism and abstract, with some paintings having one foot in each camp. Vidich says he is not technically proficient, and indeed his paintings that include animal figures have a primitive style. But he has a strong sense of color. There are clear influences of Gauguin and Van Gogh in his work. Interested readers can view a selection of his paintings at www.easthurley.com. Vidich says that he began painting many years ago as a way to relax. The more stress in his life, the more he paints. He was particularly prolific the year he divorced. Vidich seems to enjoy whatever he is doing, whether it is trading or being interviewed. He has a loud, booming laugh, which was triggered often in our interview, as he was clearly amused by his recollections. Vidic opened our conversation by asking why I had selected him for an interview.
Why you? That's relatively easy. In terms of return/risk, in the 10 years you have been running this fund, you have generated better numbers than 99% of the managers out there, and that is exactly what I'm looking for. How did you first get involved in stocks?
I got into the stock market because my brother's friend, who was a stockbroker, was going to India to see his guru and needed someone to sit at his desk for a month to simply answer the phone. I had just graduated college and wasn't doing anything yet, so I said I would do it.
What did you do when there was a phone call from a client who wanted to place an order?
I gave it to the guy next to me. I wasn't registered, so I couldn't do anything. I eventually did get registered as a stockbroker with the same firm.
What degree did you graduate with?
I had a Master's of International Business from the Columbia School of International Affairs. Almost all the people I graduated with went to work for international banks, who were hiring big at the time, or foreign service. I had no interest in working for a corporation.
Did you actually look for a job after you received your master's?
My kids say, Dad, you never even tried looking for a job. And in a sense, they are right. I did go for a number of interviews with banks after I graduated, but I just felt I wasn't the right person to get into that environment. There was something holding me back from being interested.
What appealed to you about being a stockbroker?
It was the high energy.
Had you learned anything by the time you became registered as a stockbroker?
I had a friend who had been trading stocks since he was a kid. After I became a stockbroker, he told me, Joe, you don't know anything. But I had a lot of enthusiasm. He was right, though. I didn't know anything. I was probably dangerous to my customers. I was literally following the firm's research, but if you work for a firm that has bad ideas, you don't have a chance.
When did you begin trading?
I am not a cold caller. It's not in me to call someone up and try to solicit business. I am not a salesman, never have been, never will be. I'm actually the exact opposite. I never made much in commissions, but then my three best accounts all disappeared for different reasons. An old-time trader I knew advised me that I should ask my boss permission to trade my own account. I took his advice and I went to my boss and I said, "Can I set up my own trading account because I really don't have any other income?"
He laughs harder and louder than usual at this recollection.
He offered me a deal to set up my own account with the authority to carry up to $30,000 on positions overnight, providing I put up $2,000 of my own money. I would be allowed to keep any profits, and the firm would keep all the commissions. That sounded like a good deal to me. I did okay, averaging about $4,000 a month.
Any trades stand out from that time period?
One of the stockbrokers in the office kept touting this stock, ERLY Industries. So I finally bought some. When I bought the stock, it was 7.5 bid, 7¾ offered. I didn't realize that the stock frequently traded at a $1 spread.
Another hearty laugh.
So right after I bought it at 7¾, all of a sudden it was 6¾ bid. I only had $2,000 in the account and I had bought 2,000 shares. That meant if I tried getting out of the stock, my equity would be wiped out. I was stuck in that stock for about 2 weeks. Finally, the bid came back to 7.5, and I took my loss immediately. I didn't care. It was such a thin stock that I was just happy to get out.
In those early days, what did you learn about trading that was useful?
I learned that it is always better to do your own work and get your own information because then you will have some more confidence. If you listen to someone else get into a trade and things go bad, then you have to listen to that person again to get you out. I have a real antipathy towards outside research analysts calling us with trading ideas because if you follow their advice to get into a trade, then you have to wait for their advice to get out and things can change. The price could be down 10% or 15% before they call you again.
What else did you learn?
I learned that low-priced stocks can be terrible or great. You have to look at the valuation of the company. Chrysler was a penny stock. Global Marine traded for $1 and went to $90. A few years ago, some of the best companies in America traded down to a few dollars. Dow Chemical traded for $5. Now it is back to $38. Why did it trade down to $5? Because everyone was afraid. People seeing their money disappear started redeeming their mutual fund and hedge fund investments. Faced with liquidations, mutual fund and hedge fund managers had no choice but to liquidate, regardless of the price. The down move became a self-fulfilling trend until something changed. When that change occurred, there was a tremendous upside in the various names. There are times when fear dominates. Those are the times you have to be a buyer. Those are the times of great opportunity.
Anything else?
I learned the danger in selling expensive stocks just because they are overpriced and buying value stocks just because they are underpriced. Pricey stocks are always 30% pricier than they should be because people are willing to own them at 30% above what they should own them at. A good growth stock is always overvalued, and a lousy company is always undervalued. That is the danger of buying value stocks. Until you get the turn where the market recognizes an improvement in the business model, they are always going to be undervalued. If you're going to short a growth stock because it is 30% overvalued, it is going to grow for the next 5 years always being 30% overvalued until it finally breaks, and by that time, you are probably not going to be there. Why do you believe you have done so well? One reason that I have done well is the evolution of information flow in the marketplace. When the SEC adopted fair disclosure in 2000, it meant that company conference calls had to be open to everyone. Information could no longer be controlled by the large brokerage firms, who then funneled it out to the public. I am not an expert on everything. When you listen to a conference call, you hear what the analyst's questions are, and the analysts generally know a lot more about the company than I do. When analysts key in on certain things, it tells you what they think is important. Can you give me examples of conference calls you listened to that directly led to trades? We shorted Citigroup at $48 in 2008 before it crashed. Why did we go short? The earnings report had come out for Citigroup and the stock was down $2. That was a really big move for Citigroup, so I decided to listen to the conference call. I understood banks in terms of their basic business, but I didn't understand anything that was said about CDOs or anything else to do with mortgage-backed securitizations. But the key thing I realized from the call was that not a single analyst understood it either. You could tell from their questions that they didn't know what was going on, and confusion is an opportunity, so I went short the stock. Any other examples? A number of years ago, when we were long a lot of coal stocks, one of the coal company conference calls mentioned that they had to place large orders for coal cars because they just didn't have enough cars to meet all the demand. I immediately checked a number of companies that manufactured coal cars and noticed they were all generally flatlining in price. We knew at least one large coal company was going to be a major buyer, but this fact was not reflected at all in the price. So we went long Trinity Industries, which was one of the manufacturers of coal cars. If Trinity had been up dramatically, then maybe the impending increase in the demand for coal cars would have already been priced in. But you could tell from the flat price action that it was not priced in. As another example, in 2007 and 2008, I listened to a number of conference calls with coal, oil, and natural gas companies in which they indicated that they would be deferring their capital expenditures. What do you do then? You go out and you look for companies that are in the capital equipment space selling to those industries because you know their orders are going to slow down. There is a definite opportunity to short those names. In sharp contrast to most long-short funds who experienced significant losses in 2008, you had a very good year. How did you achieve those results? We were short mortgage lenders and a lot of the bank stocks. I listened to the countrywide conference calls every quarter. I remember Mozilla, the CEO, saying that because Wall Street was getting into the business in a major way, the spreads were being cut more and more, and therefore they had to take greater and greater risks. At the same time, default rates had begun to rise. It was clear that the housing bubble couldn't be sustained and that companies like Countrywide and Washington Mutual were good shorts. I didn't know they would go down as much as they did, but I knew there was no way they would be going higher. I didn't necessarily understand the intricacies of the mortgage securitizations, but I realized that the banks were heavily leveraged in this product. On top of that, when politicians are making statements that certain banks deserve to fail, why would anyone want to own bank stocks? I had seen it all before. I had seen a number of big banks go to zero during the S&L crisis. I had seen insiders at these banks buying on the way down. Even they were caught by the greater trend, which they didn't see.
Besides being short banks and mortgage lenders, what other trades accounted for your 2008 gains?
Energy stocks were a major winner for us in 2008. During the first half of the year, we made money on the long side. Then prices started going way beyond what we thought was reasonable, so we scaled out of our position. When prices went up even more, we started going net short. When energy stock prices broke after the reversal in crude oil, we switched back to the long side around the time when crude had fallen back to the $90 level, which it turned out was way too early. But then we realized that things were getting worse and worse, so we took our losses on the longs, went back short, and played the trend down. Also, we had a lot of days when the market opened up sharply higher and closed sharply lower. One thing I learned as a trader is that if the market, Dow, moves up 400 points in the morning, you usually don't go much further.
Every time there was a big rally, we would put our shorts on, and on a sell-off, we would cover the shorts.
Nick Davidge, who has been sitting in for the interview, interjects, I annualized our turnover for the second half of 2008, and it was 23x, of which 21x was in trades initiated as shorts.
When did you transition from a net bearish bias in late 2008 back to a bullish bias?
We went long after Obama was elected. There was tremendous disenchantment with the Bush administration at that point. They had lost confidence across the board, including a lot of the business community. Obama was talking about policies to get the economy going. He was going to spend money. He was going to save the states, which were going down big time. No matter what you think of the policies, they were throwing money back into the system, which was bullish. In early 2009, we started looking around for the best business models and balance sheets we could buy. We were looking for stocks with the lowest financial risk, companies that did not need to refinance debt, and could ride out a prolonged deep recession. We went long a bunch of the non-debt retailers who had lots of cash and had gotten crushed. Stocks like Gap, which was an $11 stock with $5 in cash and over $1 in earnings. We bought Shaw, which had $12 in cash and had fallen all the way to $18.
Are there mistakes you learned from as a trader?
As an equity trader, I learned the short selling lessons relatively early. There is no high for a concept stock. It is always better to be long before they have already moved a lot than try to figure out where to go short.
What are examples of concept stocks?
The internet stocks in the 1990s and biotech stocks in the late 1990s to early 2000s.
How about a current example?
The cloud computing companies. When PE multiplies get to 50, 60, or 70, you are in the realm of concept stocks.
I understand that you do both position trading and short-term trading. Is there something about the way prices move intraday that is helpful in short-term trading?
Yes. Do you know what happens in a bull market? Prices open up lower and then go up for the rest of the day. In a bear market, they open up higher and go down for the rest of the day. When you get to the end of a bull market, prices start opening up higher. Prices behave that way because in the first half hour, it is only the fools that are trading or people who are very smart.
Sounds like a dangerous combination. Why is there a tendency to open counter to the prevailing trend?
When the market closes near the high of the move, there will be some traders who want to sell near the high, and they will be sellers on the next day's opening.
Are there any other useful short-term patterns?
If there is bearish news before the opening and the market does not trade down much during the first hour, it indicates that the smart money is not selling and that the dip is a buying opportunity.
Do you use sentiment indicators in your trading?
CNBC is my sentiment indicator.
He laughs loudly.
It is the best sentiment indicator and it's free.
How do you judge sentiment?
I judge it based on how the stock moves. If everyone is bearish because that's what CNBC says, that is public sentiment, but if the stock gaps higher after a conference call, that's the market sentiment. What matters is the market sentiment, not public sentiment. I tried to drown out public sentiment, except if public sentiment is so heavily one-sided.
How do you judge that? You watch CNBC. What is your opinion on stop orders?
They are for fools.
Do you want to expound?
If you want to ensure that you get the low of the day, use a stop. People tend to place their stops near the same price level, usually at a new recent low. If the low for a stock during the past year has been 30, there will be a lot of stops placed just below 30. If the market trades down to 30, the stops will be hit. And since there will usually be a lack of buy orders at the new lows, prices will gap lower. If we like a stock, we will sometimes try to place our buy orders 0.5 point below where we believe the stops are. If you have a stop order in the market, it means that one price will dictate the outcome. That is a bad concept. You can, however, use mental stops, which are essentially evaluation points. If the stock is down, say, 15%, you should evaluate why it is down 15%, but you shouldn't automatically sell it there. Stop orders may be okay for some public investors, but not for professionals. Stop orders are an outrageously poor way to manage risk.
What is the right way to manage risk?
The right way to manage risk is to monitor your positions and to have a mental point at which you reevaluate the position. The amount of room you will allow till that point would be different for different stocks. Each stock has its own risk profile. Some stocks could go down 50%, and it wouldn't necessarily mean anything. But for a stock like Coca-Cola, you should be reevaluating it if it moves 5% against you.
Don't ever consider yourself right. The hardest thing is to sell on the way down. It's emotionally difficult because you believe you're right or that you will eventually be right. The best way I have found to do it is to begin by selling 20% of the position. That doesn't hurt, and if the stock comes back, I can still say I was right. If the stock goes lower, I can also say I was right because at least I sold 20% of the stock higher.
Is that what you typically do? Scale out of a position?
Yes, I scale out and I also scale in. The idea is don't try to be 100% right.
So the message is if you can't take the loss, take a little bit of a loss.
That way you will never be completely wrong, and you can reassess the situation if the market goes lower. It is also about keeping the portfolio from weighing you down. Sometimes, though, it is best to just liquidate the entire position. It is a good idea to harvest your losses because it forces you to revisit the trade. If you are in the trade, you are always defending it. Liquidating forces you to reevaluate the trade relative to other opportunities. You sold the position. Do you really want to buy it back? Or would you rather put the money on this other idea which looks a lot better right now?
Vidic has to take a break from the interview to check on the markets. I take the opportunity to speak to Davidge, who has been sitting in on the interview and probably understands Vidic's approach better than anyone else. Davidge begins by giving his own take of Vidic's methodology.
One of the key characteristics of Joe's trading is his willingness and ability to gradually take losses. Joe's comments about the emotional benefits of taking losses incrementally can give you an insight into how he manages portfolio exposure.
One point of our conversation that I was particularly confused about was Joe's comments about sentiment.
Well, there are two types of sentiment. There is the popular sentiment, as it might be expressed in the media, and then there is the sentiment that is expressed by the market. When Joe talks about sentiment, he is referring to how the market responds to external events. What is the news? What is the price action? That is what generates his view of the markets. A stock being down after a good earnings report would be an example of negative sentiment.
That is how Joe thinks about sentiment.
I was confused because most people use the word sentiment to refer to some measure of how bullish or bearish the public is. In the popular usage, bullish sentiment is bearish, whereas the way Joe uses the term, bullish sentiment, a more positive response to market news than expected, is bullish.
The use of sentiment as a contrary indicator reminds me of a funny story. In 1999, a longtime friend of mine visited me in my New York office. He is a brilliant guy. He went to Harvard, got a PhD at Penn, and ended up doing work on semantics, artificial intelligence, and computer language. I asked him, "So Bill, what are you doing with your investments these days?" He answered, "I am 100% in tech stocks." I said, "Wow, do you really think that is a prudent place to be?" "Well," he said, "I have a lot of expenses and I need the extra return." I thought to myself, if that is the way other people are thinking and acting, we are really in trouble. This is all going to end very badly. That friend, as brilliant as he is, has always been wrong about stocks, and I've used him as a contrary indicator.
Vidic returns after about 20 minutes, and we continue the interview. What are examples of market response reflecting positive or negative sentiment?
Just recently, Rockwell Automation, ROK, raised guidance for the year and the stock is down $9. What does that tell you? It tells you even though earnings are currently increasing, smart investors, there are a lot smarter guys out there than I am, are anticipating a major inflection point in earnings in the next few months.
Nick had mentioned that you had another portfolio manager working for you last year. I wonder what that experience taught you.
It taught me that I didn't need him.
Another hearty laugh.
Everyone has a different perspective. The person we hired to be a portfolio assistant had an investment style that was completely different from mine. He approached stocks from a business school perspective, looking for the best business models and best companies. That is okay, but he didn't have the courage to average down into a position. Also, the stocks that he followed were not the stocks that I followed. As the head portfolio manager, I am also the risk manager and have to follow all the positions. He was hired to help me save time, but I was spending more time following his positions, which interfered with following my own positions. Training someone to think like I do about the markets, which is more like a stream of consciousness, is very difficult. It is totally different from the way they learn to think in business school.
What are the trading rules you live by?
It is really important to manage your emotional attachment to losses and gains. You want to limit your size in any position so that fear does not become the prevailing instinct guiding your judgment. Everyone will have a different level. It also depends on what kind of stock it is. A 10% position might be perfectly okay for a large cap stock, while a 3% position in a high-flying mid-cap stock, which has frequent 30% swings, might be far too risky.
Why do most people fail at trading?
To be successful in the markets, you have to be willing to change your opinion. Most people are not willing to change their opinion. You have to be humble about your ideas.
What other mistakes do people make in trading?
Most people are more afraid of making money than losing money.
What do you mean by that?
There is no real reason to sell a stock just because it's up 20%.
I would argue that when people sell a stock when it's up 20%, it is not because they are afraid of making money, but because they are afraid of losing what they made.
Maybe you are right. They're afraid of losing money, but they are only afraid of losing gains. If the stock is down 20%, they are not going to sell it. What they are really afraid of is not being right. That is why they won't sell it when it's down 20%, because that would confirm they were wrong. Recently, my analyst in Texas, who is very good, called me about one of our positions that was way up. He said, we should probably sell some. And why? I asked him. Because we should probably lock some profits in. And why? I asked again. He didn't have a good reason. He wanted to sell to justify his idea and lock in gains on his recommendation. But that is his own world. It has nothing to do with where the stock is going. We had another position that was initially profitable, but then sold off when all the analysts downgraded the stock 3 days before the earnings report. I thought they must all know something negative and that we should be selling the stock. My analyst couldn't understand why I would want to sell the stock then, right after it had given back all the gains we had made. I wanted to get out because I thought the stock was going lower, and it did. The decision had nothing to do with where we bought the stock or what the current price was.
What personal characteristics do you believe you have that allows you to succeed in this business?
The willingness to take losses and understand that I may not be right.
Do you use objectives on your trades?
I have points where I will reevaluate, but it's a moving target. Also, I try not to sell on the way up. I try to sell on the way down.
So, if you buy a stock at 40 that you think will be fully priced at 80,
I would sell it at 75 on the way down rather than at 80 because I might be giving up much more on the upside than the difference in selling it a little bit lower.
4 months later, after listening to all the tapes of our interview, I felt that a number of important questions had either been unasked or answered unsatisfactorily. I conducted a follow-up interview by phone. By the time of this call, July 29, 2011, Bidditch had switched from bullish to bearish. In the week immediately following this call, equities plunged, experiencing their largest single-week decline since the 2008 market meltdown. When I interviewed you a few months ago, you were quite bullish. Now you are bearish. What changed?
Part of it was the recent resolution of the debt ceiling impasse, in which the entire reduction of future deficits was based on spending cutbacks without any increase in revenues. Spending cutbacks, which primarily impact lower and middle-class consumers, will have a much greater drag on the economy than increases in revenues for higher-income earners. The Tea Party has also put Obama in a corner by clearly making it impossible for him to implement any further stimulus if the economy needs it.
What else turned you bearish?
We are seeing an increasing number of companies whose operating margins are beginning to contract as their input costs increase, and those costs can't be passed on to the consumer.
Anything else?
When you listen to the numerous conference calls in which the executives are worried about the current economic environment, that sentiment translates into a real impact on business.
So the way you interpret sentiment, negative sentiment is bearish rather than bullish.
There's a big difference between informed sentiment, like CEOs, and investor sentiment. Investor sentiment, however, is usually wrong, at least over the longer term.
How do you judge investor sentiment?
One way is by listening to my own investors. When I start hearing the same comments from a number of my investors, it is a good reflection of what everyone is thinking.
For example,
when the retail stocks were getting hammered last year, my investors were all asking, "Why would you want to own any retail stocks?" Of course, that was exactly the right time to own them. That was the bottom of the retail sector.
Now that you have switched from net long to net short, what would get you long again?
Buying. If all of a sudden stocks stopped going down on bad news, that would be a positive sign.
You did extraordinarily well in 1999 and then had an even more amazing 2000. Vidich managed a very small fund before starting the current fund. This fund, which started in October 1999,
made 87% in the fourth quarter of 1999 and 147% in 2000.
You obviously had to shift from being extremely bullish in 1999 to extremely bearish in 2000. How did you manage to time this transition so well?
I didn't switch from being a bull to a bear. First, I switched from being a bull to being hedged because the stocks I was long were up by so much. Once I was hedged, I was protecting my profits, and I began to notice that I was making all my money on the shorts. As more information came out, I realized that I should be selling my longs and keeping my shorts.
Do you use charts?
Charts are extremely important. One of the best patterns is when a stock goes sideways for a long time in a narrow range and then has a sudden sharp up move on the large volume. That type of price action is a wake-up call that something is probably going on and you need to look at it. Also, sometimes whatever is going on with that stock will also have implications for other stocks in the same sector. It can be an important clue.
Does any trade stand out as your most painful experience?
If you are diversified enough, then no single trade is particularly painful. The critical risk controls are being diversified and cutting your exposure when you don't understand what the markets are doing and why you are wrong.
Has that happened recently?
I was long Google at an average price of about $550. It kept going lower, and I couldn't understand why. Finally, I just got out at $505. It went down to about $480, and then it abruptly reversed, surging above $600 in a matter of weeks. Psychologically, that is extremely painful, but you have to be willing to take your hit. Even when you are wrong in taking your hit, it cleans the slate, and cleaning the slate can be very therapeutic. If you don't clean your slate, you will end up keeping your losers. Some stocks with losses will come back, and you will sell those, but the ones that don't come back, you will end up keeping. Getting out sometimes right before a stock turns is the price you pay to keep your losses under control.
It is a common dilemma faced by traders. The market is moving against your position. You are well aware of the dangers of an unconstrained loss, but you also still believe in your position and are worried about throwing in the towel just before the market turns. You are frozen in indecision. Vidich offers a perspective that provides a solution. Don't try to be 100% right, he says, instead of making an all-or-nothing decision. When Vidich is faced with a losing position, he will often begin by liquidating part of the position. Taking a partial loss is much easier than liquidating the entire position. It allows the trader to act rather than procrastinate. If the position continues to move against Vidich, he will liquidate some more. In this way, a losing position is gradually reduced and eventually entirely liquidated if it doesn't turn around, mitigating the damage. The next time you are undecided between liquidating a losing position and gritting your teeth and riding it out, remember that there is a third alternative, partial liquidation. A common mistake made by traders is that they let their greed influence position sizing beyond their comfort level. Why put on a 5% position when you can put on a 10% position and double the profits? The problem is that the larger the position, the greater the danger that trading decisions will be driven by fear rather than by judgment and experience. Vidich stresses, limit your size in any position so that fear does not become the prevailing instinct guiding your judgment. Flexibility is a key characteristic of superior traders. Vidich is a long-term bull in the energy markets, but he doesn't let this view interfere with making the right trading decision. In 2008, when prices moved excessively on the upside, Vidich gradually transitioned from net long to net short. In the subsequent collapse in crude oil, Vidich repositioned himself back on the long side of energy equities once crude had fallen to about $90. But he soon realized that the changing fundamentals and market sentiment implied lower prices and reversed back to the short side. Crude oil prices and energy equities subsequently collapsed. Vidich's flexibility in changing his trading opinion turned a potential major loss into a large winner. Don't make trading decisions based on where you bought or sold a stock. The market doesn't care where you entered your position. When Vidich felt a stock that had just fallen all the way back to where he had bought it was going lower, he just got out, not letting his entry level affect the trading decision. If you are going to control your losses, there will be times when you will get out just before the market turns around. Get used to it. This frustrating experience is an unavoidable consequence of effective risk management. Vidich's discipline in harvesting his losses has made it possible for him to keep his maximum drawdown to single digits for over a decade and through two major bear markets. This impressive risk control, though, could only be achieved because Vidich was willing to accept the fact
that he would sometimes end up liquidating losing positions right before they reversed dramatically, as had just happened to him in his long Google position. Chapter 13. Kevin Daly. Who is Warren Buffett? Who is Warren Buffett is what Kevin Daly thought when queried about the famous investor in an initial job interview in 1983. Finding the answer to this question directly led to the investment methodology Daly employed throughout his career. True to Buffett's investment philosophy, Daly seeks out companies that are selling well below the intrinsic value of their business. He's been extremely successful in applying this methodology. After 15 years of writing equity research and eating his own cooking in his personal stock account, which grew steadily in value with the exception of a losing year in 1994, Daly launched his own fund in 1999. In the 12 years he has been running the fund, Daly has realized an average annual compounded gross return of 20.8%, 16.4% net. Although Daly does some shorting, it plays a relatively minor role, usually accounting for less than 10% of assets under management. In this context, Daly's investment approach is closer to a long-only fund. Although he will periodically hold significant percentages of cash, than to a long-short hedge fund. Since inception, Daly has earned a cumulative gross return of 872%, 514% after management and incentive fees, compared with only a 68% contemporaneous return for the Russell 2000, the most comparable index given Daly's smaller cap focus, and a negative 9% return for the S&P 500. The ability to generate substantial returns with a near long-only approach in an equity market that has gone essentially sideways over the long term tells only part of the story. Perhaps the most impressive aspect of Daly's performance has been in his control of losses. Although the equity market witnessed two huge bear phases in which stock indexes were more than halved, Daly's maximum drawdown from an equity peak to an equity low has been only 10.3%. Even more impressive in terms of risk control, with the exception of November 2000 when he lost 6%, all his other monthly losses have been under 4%. Daly's gain-to-pain ratio based on net returns is a very high 3.2. Daly earned a civil engineering degree at the University of Berkeley, but well before he graduated, he realized that he had no interest in his chosen field of study. He was bothered by the lack of creativity in the process. The answers to any specific problem were prescribed. If you knew the formulas, you would plug in the numbers, get the answer, and move on to the next problem. There was a sameness about it that was unappealing to Daly. After graduating, he enrolled in the University of San Francisco's MBA program, thinking that a career in business might provide him with the variation he sought. Daly's first job, and as it turned out only job prior to launching his hedge fund, was with Hofer & Arnett, a boutique brokerage and investment banking firm. He was originally hired as a broker, but this quickly morphed into a research position. Originally, Daly was the only research analyst, but as the firm grew and other analysts were hired, he became the research director. His Five Corners Fund was originally launched within the firm. It is probably more accurate to think of Daly as a private investor than a hedge fund manager. The hedge fund is essentially the private account he would be running if he were on his own, with a structure that allows other investors to co-invest. Daly accounted for about one-third of the invested assets when the fund launched, and still accounts for about the same percentage today. He runs the fund as a solo operation from his home office. Daly is quite happy with this simple structure, and he is downright reluctant to put any effort into raising assets for his fund, as it might necessitate expanding beyond a one-man business. He is loath to complicate what he considers the perfect current arrangement. Daly is a man whose work and hobby are the same. If Daly were retired, I believe his life would be totally unchanged. He would, no doubt, still be spending his day managing his stock account, which would be indistinguishable from the current fund. He would be doing the exact same research and investment management he is doing now. Daly is tall, trim, and very fit-looking. He regularly mountain bikes, his other main hobby besides investing, in the steep hills that sit behind his house. One of the trail junctions, Five Corners, is the origin of his fund's name, Five Corners Partners LP. I interviewed Daly in the comfortable living room of his home in the exurbs of San Francisco. He was relaxed and low-key. I could see him remaining unfazed and sedate even in panic markets.
How did you get started in the financial industry?
My first interview after graduating business school was at a small regional investment bank. I was interviewed by Alan Hoffer, who was one of the firm's three partners. During the interview, he asked me if I had ever heard of Warren Buffett.
No, I answered. Well, what are they teaching you in business school these days? He asked.
It was a long interview, and I didn't think I did particularly well. I took mental notes, and after the interview, I started doing my own research. I got Buffett's annual letters. I read up on the companies Hoffer had mentioned in the interview. Weeks went by, and I didn't hear back from him. I assumed that was it.
Why did you think you did poorly in the interview?
Well, for starters, I didn't even know who Buffett was.
It reminds me of my first interview after graduate school. I had a degree in economics, but they taught you nothing about the markets. The interview was for a job opening as a commodity research analyst. The research director asked me if I knew anything about commodities. Not really, I said, something like gold. My answer was so bad that I still remember it after all these years. Fortunately, I still got the job because I wrote my way into it. The story about your interview strikes a familiar chord. You come out of an academic background with good credentials, but you know absolutely nothing and can't answer the simplest questions in a job interview.
Exactly, that is where I found myself. The prior summer, I took a break after graduating business school to travel through Europe. While traveling, I bumped into a friend of mine who I knew from Berkeley. He had gone to business school at USC while I went to business school at USF. We got together after we returned. We started talking about our job searches, and by coincidence, it turned out we had both interviewed for the same job. He told me they had hired someone else from Berkeley. Neither one of us got the job.
They never gave you the courtesy of a call to tell you that someone else got the job?
No, they didn't, but it turned out the other person was hired as an investment banker, which was not the position I had interviewed for. After I got back, I called Hoffer and said, I'm going to be in the Burlingame area next week, which was a complete lie. Do you mind if I stop by to say hello again? Hoffer said it was fine for me to come by. I went in and ended up having lunch with Bob Arnott, who was the other founding partner in the firm. At lunch, I was talking a lot about Buffett and the companies Hoffer and Arnott were invested in because at that point I felt well-versed enough to hold my own on these topics. At one point in our conversation, Arnott looked at me and said, Are you telling me all this because you're interested in it or because you think it's what I want to hear? A little bit of both, I answered. The next week, I got an offer from them to be a broker.
Were you concerned that it was a sales position?
I didn't care. I just wanted to get my foot in the door. It was a very small firm. I hoped that if I applied myself, I wouldn't be stuck as a broker. As it turned out, I was only a broker for about 2 months.
Once you started there, what did they have you do?
They had me cold calling.
Was it difficult?
Yes, it was very difficult. Some of the people on my call list were dead.
Did you get any accounts?
No, I didn't get any.
Were you getting frustrated?
Yes, I didn't like it at all. After about 2 months, I started writing research on my own. I covered companies that were not followed on Wall Street, which gave us greater access to managers and the large mutual fund companies. Our focus was on value. Both Hoffer and Arnott taught me to look at companies from the perspective of what would a rational businessman pay for the company if he was writing a check today. One interesting aspect of the business for me was that unlike the large brokerage firms that had a salesman between the analysts and clients, we wrote and sold our own research. This structure gave me the opportunity to meet with some of the major mutual fund managers, such as John Templeton, Chuck Royce, and Bob Rodriguez, who were clients.
I guess these funds directed commission business to you in exchange for the research ideas.
Exactly.
Did you learn anything from these clients?
By coincidence, I was in New York at the time of the 1987 crash. In doing my manager visits on that day, I saw three very different responses to the crash. Some guys, when I walked into their office, were almost catatonic. All they could do was stare at the screen, watching the market evaporate in front of them. They couldn't buy and they couldn't sell. They would apologize for not being able to take the meeting, and I completely understood. I saw other clients who were selling in panic mode. Then I saw Chuck Royce, who took our meeting as if nothing were happening.
He sat in an office that had a glass screen divider between him and his trading desk. Each time I finished discussing an idea, he would slide the glass window open and tell one of his traders to buy 50,000 shares. He wasn't afraid to keep buying. The way he responded taught me that you have to stay focused on the value of a business and see past exogenous crisis events. Stocks get cheaper than fair value. It may be painful to buy into a panic over the short run, but over the long run, it can pay off if you are buying stocks well below their value.
What prompted you to start a hedge fund?
I had been doing research for 15 years, and I thought I was pretty good at it. I had also been investing in the ideas that I was recommending all along. Starting a hedge fund seemed like a natural outgrowth of what I had already been doing. Also, I was able to start the fund within my own firm. I launched the fund in 1999 with $3 million. One-third was my own money, and Chuck Royce and friends and family accounted for the rest. When I started the fund, it was right in the middle of the internet craze. I found some good value names in that space.
How could you possibly have found value in internet stocks in 1999?
I found fiber optic businesses that were buried inside of larger companies. You could buy some of these companies for PEs as low as 11 or 12 and effectively get a free call on the fiber optic portion of their business, which was not reflected in the price. One example was Newport Corporation, which was primarily known as a company that produced test and measurement equipment for the semiconductor industry. When I purchased it in 1999 at the pre-split price of $14 per share, it was trading around 11 times next year's earnings, had a nice balance sheet, and was very capably managed. What most investors didn't realize at the time was that the company contained a division, accounting for a quarter of total sales, that produced products used in the fiber optic component manufacturing process. In other words, they made products that helped build the information superhighway. As fiber optic networks were built out, Newport's little division benefited. Sales increased by 80% in 2000, and the share price rose even faster. In 2000, I began taking profits in the 30s, thinking that at those levels the stock had reached intrinsic value. I sold the last of my shares around $100, at which point I thought the stock was grossly overvalued. I failed to appreciate that in a market where internet stocks, with little or even no earnings and minuscule revenues, could magically levitate to stratospheric levels based on silly metrics like sales per engineer, there was no telling how high a real company like Newport could go. Later that year, the stock eventually topped out at $570 per share. I have tried to do that type of investing throughout the fund's life, looking for companies that are somewhat obscure, not covered by Wall Street, or have a niche business inside the company that no one is focusing on. I use the smallness of the fund to my advantage. I can go down to smaller cap values that the larger funds can't look at.
What cap range do you focus on?
I'm pretty agnostic in terms of capitalization levels. I can go big or small. It is really value that drives my interest. My focus is on buying a company at a discount to intrinsic value, which can be measured in a lot of different ways depending on the business. Market cap is not a factor.
Since you are agnostic about market cap, you must have a very large investment universe.
About 10,000 stocks.
How do you select stocks from such a large list?
I use CompuStat and Zacks to screen their lists of U.S. and Canadian stocks.
What metrics do you use to screen for stocks that may be of interest?
The accounting for financial companies is quite different from that of non-financial companies, so I use different screens for each. For non-financial companies, I use some of the following.
Enterprise value, EBITDA.
Enterprise value, EV, is equal to the company's market cap, the number of shares outstanding times the share price, plus all long-term liabilities, debt and preferred stock outstanding, as well as underfunded pension funds, minus cash. The enterprise value is the amount one would have to pay to acquire the entire business. EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, is a measure of the amount of cash flow the business produces annually. The ratio measures what you are paying relative to what you are getting. I look for companies trading at low multiples of EBITDA. price to free cash flow. FCF is the money a company has left over after it has paid all expenses and made capital investments. It can be used to pay dividends, repurchase shares, or make acquisitions. The aim is to find businesses selling at low multiples of FCF. P/E ratio, the current price per share divided by the forecasted earnings.